Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Later today, Betsy DeVos will sit before the Senate for her confirmation hearing to become the next Secretary of Education. The billionaire activist has been a huge proponent of school choice, including vouchers for religious and other private schools, all of which closely aligns with President-elect Trump's positions. If she's confirmed, DeVos will become only the 11th Secretary of Education because the department is relatively new. Joining us now to give us an inside look into the department she would head is Louis Friedberg, Executive Director of EdSource, a nonprofit journalism website centered on California education issues mostly, but certainly with national implications. Louis, welcome to WNYC. Thanks for coming on.
Good to be here, Brian.
So I'm curious about how much power DeVos would have. And by the way, can we do the pronouncer first? Is it DeVos, 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 DeVos?
DeVos.
DeVos. Okay, so I got it right the first time.
Pretty good.
I'm curious about how much power she would have even without Congress changing education law. So the straight line from Trump through DeVos to our local public schools. For example, during Obama's tenure, the Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan, was closely aligned with the president and issued various rules that I think brought significant change in the public schools around the country. Did Obama use the department to affect education on the ground without having to go through Congress every time? And can we expect the same thing from a Trump-DeVos administration?
Well, that's correct. I mean, the secretary does have quite a lot of authority. Now, the Obama administration had some advantages. They got, like, the Race to the Top Fund in New York State, got $700 million of that. They set up this massive Race to the Top Fund, and they put all kinds of contingencies on that, requiring basically encouraging local school districts to tie teacher evaluations to measures of student growth, which included test scores and kind of nudging states to adopt the Common Core and so on.
By the way, maybe the most conservative thing that the Obama administration did. And it didn't get all that much press during the 8 years. We talked about it here. But adopting high-stakes standardized test model, not only for evaluating students but evaluating teachers, and as you were just describing, pressuring states to have their local school districts evaluate teachers based on standardized tests more in order to get this extra funding.
Well, that's actually correct. I mean, in many ways, the Obama administration continued basically the basic framework of No Child Left Behind, this kind of top-down accountability model. And in many people's eyes, this was the most intrusive federal interference in state and local education. I mean, education in the United States is basically supposed to be a local function. We have elected school boards in every community across the country. So this was a pretty extreme example of federal basic federal government more or less dictating what states and school districts should be doing.
Did the Department of Education have to go through Congress to get approval for that Race to the Top program?
Well, in the Race to the Top, what happened there was that they got money from the stimulus grant. There was a massive $110 billion stimulus grant. And so they did not really have to go through Congress in terms of the requirements that they would put on, that they put on receiving those funds. And that is an area where the secretary has a lot of power. The new secretary could also put various kinds of conditions on grants. They wouldn't actually have to make it mandatory, but they could say that you would have an increased ability to get funds if you did certain things. And so the secretary could certainly look for ways, for example, to encourage states, and I put quotes, put that in quotes, encourage states to set up school choice programs that might include vouchers of some kind. So that's in terms of various grant programs, they could put in certain requirements there.
That's one way that a voucher program could come about without Congress passing an actual law. Also, during Obama, I know the Education Department has an Office of Civil Rights. Were they pretty assertive during the Obama administration in using it?
Hugely assertive. And in fact, this is one of the more controversial aspects of the Department of Education, and there have been definitely signals coming from Congress and Senator Lamar Alexander's office. He is the head of the Senate Education Committee, that they don't like the Office of Civil Rights, and that I think there's a lot of expectation, depending on which side of the aisle you're on, or fear that the powers of this department, of the Office of Civil Rights, will be trimmed.
Tell me more about that. Who doesn't like the powers of the Office of Civil Rights in the Education Department, and how do you think the Obama folks used it to effect the most change?
Well, they were quite assertive, for example, in looking at things like school discipline. They looked at how discipline, suspension, and expulsions were disproportionately affecting African American and Latino students, for example. And we have a case in California where the Oakland Unified School District had to set up a program. I mean, they agreed to it to try to address those issues. So that was one issue. Another very controversial issue was this issue of transgender bathrooms, allowing gender-free bathrooms. That happened last May.
That was an Education Department Civil Rights Office rule.
That was actually a joint thing between the Justice Department and the Department of Education. Both the Justice Department and the Office of and the Department of Education have Office of Civil Rights. So sometimes it gets a little confusing here to know which department's office is issuing it. But in that case, mm-hmm. it was definitely a joint effort of the Justice Department and the Department of Education, both Secretary John King, the current Secretary of Education, and the Attorney General were involved in that case. That's been hugely unpopular in many conservative states. There was also those are two of the areas where the department has been, the Office of Civil Rights has been involved. But they look at thousands of cases, thousands of complaints. I mean, anybody can file a complaint with the department, and they will investigate it. I don't think it's likely that they will abolish the office, but what you could do is just not fill certain positions. There's regional offices around the country. You can just kind of let those regional offices languish, and basically, you know, send a signal that they're not looking for the office to be very assertive.
Yeah, they can do things.
Something that's on the table.
We may be looking at this in the Justice Department, too, under Jeff Sessions, if he's confirmed. Not everything that might affect civil rights enforcement has to do with things he will do. A lot of it might have to do with things he won't do, just cases he won't take, decisions not to oversee or investigate certain local police departments, and there may be parallels to that in education, as I hear you explaining. Listeners, my guest is Louis Friedberg. He's executive director of the education news website EdSource. And with the confirmation hearings for the education secretary nominee, Betsy DeVos, scheduled for later today, I think it starts around 5 o'clock.
That's correct, kind of late in the day.
Because there are so many confirmation hearings to have that they have to do them on shifts. Listeners, if you have a question about her, about the hearings, about the power of the Education Department to affect schools with or without change, with or without Congress, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. I thought it might be interesting for people to hear a little bit of the history of the Education Department because it is fairly new. This only dates back to the Carter administration, doesn't it?
Well, that's correct. Well, okay, this is a little known fact that in 1866, when President Andrew Johnson was president, they did actually establish a department. And the department was in existence for exactly 1 year, and then it was abolished because, for the same reasons, that there's been a lot of opposition to the department, particularly amongst Republicans and Republican presidents for the last 30, 40 years. But because basically the argument was that education is a local function and the federal government shouldn't be meddling in what happens at a local level. So there was an Office of Education, but not a full department. And then May 1980, just right at the tail end of President Carter's term, they established the department, and actually Ronald Reagan ran on a platform to abolish the department. So that has been...
Why didn't he do it?
Good question. This has been on the agenda of every Republican platform, Republican Party platform. George W. Bush actually did not run on a platform to abolish the department, although the party itself did. Hard to abolish the department. I mean, basically, you've got the department has about 5,000 employees. It has a budget of about $70 billion, and it oversees a zillion different programs. So it's not only in K-12, it's also higher ed, it's vocational education, includes adult education programs across the country, student loan programs, and not easy to abolish a department. You'd have to have somebody would have to take over all those functions.
They'd have to distribute functions that the federal government isn't going to abandon to other departments. What you mentioned student loans. DeVos would have something to say about student loan policy?
Absolutely. This is one area where DeVos may have actually more influence than over K-12 policy, because last December, Congress approved the extension of the successor, shall we say, to the No Child Left Behind law. It's called the Every Student Succeeds Act. That was passed last December. President Obama signed it. He called it a Christmas miracle because nobody actually expected Congress to come up with a bipartisan bill.
So what did they pass that President Obama likes?
It's called the Every Student Succeeds Act, and it was a compromise. Basically, what it does reverse some of this top-down federal approach of the No Child Left Behind law and does give the states now much more decision-making powers than they had before. They basically are leaving it up to the states to set up their own accountability systems. They basically prohibit the secretary, for example, to impose national standards or even to kind of suggest to states what kinds of accountability systems they should have. It just says they need to have some kind of high standards. And so this is a big shift. So the basic issue of the relationship between the federal government and local school districts has been somewhat resolved in the direction of devolving power much more closely to the states.
That sounds like a bill that President Obama might have vetoed. Why did he sign it?
Well, it was a compromise. It definitely was a compromise, and they were able to get some, in terms of some of the issues we've just talked about, in terms of civil rights protections. The civil rights groups were very, very upset about some of the major aspects of this bill. So they were able to get some provisions in there that they hope the department will enforce. But the fact that we have an administration just along the lines we've been talking that is not that friendly to this notion of civil rights enforcement, I think, has many of the civil rights organizations very, very concerned that this law will have very little teeth, but it will require the secretary to actively enforce some of these provisions. And if he or she doesn't, or in this case it's going to be Secretary Betsy DeVos, unless something, you know, very unexpected happens. So I think there's a lot of concern that even some of the compromise provisions that were in the bill won't be enforced.
My guest is Louis Friedberg, executive director of the education news website EdSource. As we preview the confirmation hearings later today for Education Secretary nominee Betsy DeVos, and also talk about what powers the Education Department and Education Secretary have over your child's education, your school district's education, even without a new act of Congress. And Peter in Connecticut, you're on WNYC. Hi, Peter.
Hi, good morning, Brian. How are you?
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so listen, my wife is a teacher in a town in Connecticut. I'm not going to mention the specific town because our superintendent has a lot of tends to have retribution against anyone who challenges him. But she's become very disgusted with teaching. She's been teaching about 10 years, teaches English, and she's basically ready to quit because of the standardized testing and how all the data and all the processing that they have to do has destroyed her desire to teach. And she teaches in a, I guess it's a disadvantaged district. I don't know what the term is.
Mm-hmm.
But our frustration is that Obama really didn't move the ball forward as far as making life better for teachers. And it seems that more blame has been put on teachers than anything. And my question really comes to you about, for your guest, is this new Secretary of Education. She seems to want to destroy public education even more by attacking the teachers. And what is our government going to do about improving morale for teachers, because they're really disgusted, and every teacher in her school is disgusted. So I think you're going to have a problem in this country, you know, especially with this administration, where you're, you know, destroying people's desire to do the job.
And one of the big problems is if they talk about a shortage of qualified teachers and want to be able to more easily fire teachers who aren't doing a good job at the same time as cracking down on teachers' quality of life, as you're describing with your wife, their autonomy in the classroom, their feeling of job satisfaction, where are the best and the brightest going to come from who want to go into this field? So, Louis Friedberg, what would you say about this? I mean, Peter raises a collection of issues. Maybe you want to talk about DeVos positions or Trump positions on further cracking down, term he used, on teachers, or what do you think is going to come from them in this respect?
Yeah, well, this is a major, major problem and it's reaching crisis level proportions. So in California, we have a massive shortage of teachers in certain areas, and I know states across the country are dealing with that. So this is something that you would hope the department will take on. The fact, however, is that the secretary-elect, I guess we call her that, Betsy DeVos, really, her focus has been finding alternatives to public schools. We've looked at her record. We haven't found any strong statement that indicates that she thinks that public schools, traditional public schools, could be improved and made workable. And, of course, that's where the vast majority of students are and, of course, the vast majority of teachers are. So I think this is an area of concern, because this should be a major priority of the department to figure out how to improve working conditions for teachers. Now, it is true that in the last few months of the Obama administration, they did start coming around to saying too much testing. And there is kind of an inclination in this new federal law, this Every Student Succeeds Act, that says that schools and districts shouldn't be evaluated solely on test scores, that you could use multiple measures. They do say that test scores should still comprise the bulk of how you evaluate the school and the district. But there is a shift happening, and hopefully that shift is being reflected in local school districts, because I think certainly parents, and I have kids in public schools, this emphasis on testing, this testing regimen which we've had for the last 15, 16 years under No Child Left Behind, really went too far. And the authors of that bill who basically have acknowledged that that wasn't there. They didn't think that that's what would happen, but that's what did happen. So hopefully we're seeing a shift in that direction.
Peter, thank you for your call. Megan in Highland Falls, you're on WNYC. Hello, Megan.
Yes, hi, good morning. I was calling. I grew up in Michigan and I'm very familiar with the DeVos family, actually in the same town where the DeVosses are from, and seeing how vocally opposed the DeVos family has been to public education. They are very pro-Christian education, pro-vouchers, as we know, and have no experience. She has no experience as a school teacher, an administrator. I'm very concerned about what this could mean for our schools. I know a lot of this you've already talked about on your show, but she has so many ties to big business with Amway, her husband's business, and also through her brother, Eric Prince, who owns Blackwater, which we're all familiar with from the Iraq War and some of the atrocities that happened there. So being familiar with them throughout my life, I was devastated to hear that she is the current secretary pick for education.
Would the Amway or Blackwater connections have any implication, as you see it, for education policy? Certainly there are rich people who are, you know, policy progressives. There are rich people who are policy conservatives. Is there any relationship there, or are you just generally concerned?
They have had many, many ties to the Christian schools, and she has made a lot of statements about God and education and Christian faith and education. That is what really concerns me. I think as a nation, we really need to separate church and state, and I don't see that happening under her. I think that that line will be very blurred given her background in being so supportive of Christian education.
Lewis, how about religion and education under this education secretary if she's confirmed?
Well, I think that's a real concern. I mean, Betsy DeVos herself attended religious schools, and these vouchers would, depending on the state, could be used for religious schools. I mean, it couldn't happen in California. We have our constitution prohibits public money is going to sectarian schools. So I think a lot depends on individual states as to what will be possible. But, you know, definitely her view is that private schools, whether they are sectarian, religious, or otherwise, should be available to all parents. And that has been really her major focus over quite a few decades. And so that is definitely going to be an issue that will come up this afternoon at her confirmation hearing.
I know you're in California, and that reference that you just made to California law is really interesting. Maybe we're going to see debates like this in New York and other states that have fairly liberal state legislatures, whether to, and I don't honestly know whether our local states, New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut, already have the same laws as California or similar laws prohibiting, did you say prohibiting?
Public monies from being used for religious schools.
For religious schools. So if that becomes a federal policy or a federal offer, maybe we're going to wind up seeing debates in Albany and Trenton and Hartford and capitals around the country to decide whether to enable this or block it, you think?
Yes, I think this is definitely going to put these issues on the table, but I think the policy of the administration is, initially at least, is going to be to work with states that already allow vouchers who are friendly to this approach.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, that is kind of in the very kind of sketchy plan that President-elect Trump issued during the campaign.
Work with meaning get more federal money to them?
Well, they might say, we'll set up a program. Let's say they'll find some money. Congress would authorize some money that would set certain conditions and say you could apply for it. And so states who are disposed to this to start off with could apply, and those states that don't want to won't. So, for example, California, I think there's a view that this whole voucher thing is a completely non-starter. If they did set up a program where the state could apply for it, California definitely wouldn't. And I'm sure there are many other states that would be in that position. So I think initially the idea would be to see where they could find fertile ground for this and then see how they could expand it over time.
Lewis Friedberg, Executive Director of EdSource. Thank you so much for giving us this time today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And we'll see how these things are discussed when the confirmation hearing for Betsy DeVos to be Education Secretary begins at 5 o'clock this afternoon. John Avlon, editor of the Daily Beast, next. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.